My friends and I went to play this course, Bryant Lake Park. We showed up and there was a cop sitting in the lot turning everybody away because the course was closed for the season. And we were turned away and we were really mad because we drove like 40 minutes to get there. We didn't know that part of town. And so we pulled over on a side road, we figured out a course and we went and played. And I was just like, this shouldn't be so hard. Like there should be a way to just use this nice GPS that's in my phone to say, tell me where all the courses are near here. I got frustrated and I was like, this should exist. Most people have smartphones these days. I love the sport. Like, I think it's time to dedicate a lot of time towards solving this.
Welcome to Patent Pending, a show about the future of disc golf. I'm Jesse from Trash Panda, and on the show today, how Matt Kruger used his interest in technology to solve a problem faced by every disc golfer. UDisc is known as the app for disc golfers, and rightly so, because if you're a disc golfer, then it's highly likely that you use or at least know what UDisc is. Whether you find yourself using it to keep score, follow professional disc golf events, or simply find the next course you want to visit, UDisc has become a linchpin in our sport. But if you're like me and have been playing since before 2012, then you might remember the days before UDisc. Like looking up directions before you left the house, guessing the distance on each hole when signs just weren't there, and spending a ridiculous amount of time simply trying to navigate your way through the course. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, then that's thanks in large part to Matt Kruger. Because while I was just trying to get from one hole to the next, Matt began to solve the problem for him and his friends. Little did he know, 1.1 million other people would be faced with the same exact issue.
I always was somebody who leaned towards technology. I always enjoyed tinkering with electronics, whether it was like, you know, a cassette player or something when I was really little, or I remember getting my very first like CD player, like a portable one. Mm-hmm. When I was in third grade, I was 8. And I remember getting my first CD player and I waited till they had the good like anti-shock technology. If you're old enough to remember, like, you know, a CD is being read by a laser and if it bounces around in your pocket, like it can't read the song and it would start to skip. And so they came out with like anti-skip technology that was 10 seconds. So you could like bobble it around for 10 seconds before it would start to skip. Wow. So I remember like getting one of those when I was like 8, getting really into music. And I think music was really, in my opinion, music is what got me into tech. So I was like, I loved music. Probably shouldn't talk about it on the air, but I will anyway, because I think it's part of my story. But like I got, you know, when Napster first came out, like I was really, really into that. Like I had just gotten a good internet connection. I was, you know, on Napster before it was outlawed and was just, you know, discovering tons of music. And I just remember being like, this is so cool. And I actually remember thinking at one point, maybe like foreshadowing to the future, being like, how cool would it be to be the guy that made Napster? Like something that like a lot of people enjoy. I remember thinking of the whole process of like downloading, like going somewhere, clicking on something, downloading this application and using it to unlock like this whole new world. So yeah, my relationship with tech was really just music got me super into computers. From that, it led me to like needing to upgrade the RAM on this very old computer I had because it wasn't powerful enough to like play a song and do something else at the same time. Like you could only play an MP3 in Winamp or have Microsoft Word open and be typing something. You couldn't have both. And so I remember figuring out somehow like how to fix that. And I had to go to Best Buy and pick up. I actually remember that computer had 16 megabytes of RAM and I upgraded it to 64 megabytes of RAM, but not gigabytes, megabytes. Yeah. So we're talking like compared to today, we're talking, you know, very small amounts, but that enabled me to be able to do two things at the same time. And then once I could do two things at the same time, I was like, there's this new technology coming out, CD burning. And I was like, ooh, you know, if I had a CD burner, I could burn these songs that I've downloaded on a CD. And so I saved up money, went to Best Buy, bought a CD burner, figured out how to install it in my computer. And I was, you know, I was probably like 11 or 12, maybe 12 or something. Opening up the computer to do the RAM and to do the CD burner, like that is really what was the gateway for me just to be like, I want to do something with computers when I get older.
Wow. That was like opening up Pandora's box for you. It was like, here we go.
It was for sure.
So you make your way eventually to Iowa State, and at some point, two crucial elements enter the story. One is your co-founder, Josh, and another is Stable Run Disc Golf Course in Ames, Iowa. Can you talk about both of those?
Yeah, Stable Run is a great course that is in Ames, Iowa, and it wasn't my first time ever playing. I'd played a few times as a child, actually. There was a course that was built less than a mile from my parents' house that I played a handful of times when I was like 12, and then didn't touch it again, but knew what disc golf was.
Yeah.
Got to Iowa State, got through my freshman year living in the dorms, which is kind of like the other side of, it's like the south side of campus. My sophomore year, I lived in these apartments. They're like on-campus apartments where thousands of people live. They're like, it's a very big, like complex of apartments. Mm-hmm. And Stable Run was literally across the road. And there were like shortcuts you could take to get there, like, you know, just jaywalk straight across the road and like walk through the woods, get down to the first tee. And so I had a roommate, Alex, who he had played a bunch in high school. And once we lived together, you know, he was one of the people in the apartment with me. I don't exactly remember how it happened, but we started playing just all the time, just about every day. And that actually is kind of when I met Josh as well. So he was the same major as me, computer engineering major. I had known like him peripherally, like he was in some of my classes, but I hadn't really chatted with him.
Yeah.
And then sophomore year at some point, through my roommate Alex and some other people I had met freshman year, we ended up like doing some homework together for one of the classes that we were in. So when I went to Iowa State, I live in Minneapolis, so it's like 3.5 hours south. I didn't really know anybody at that school. I knew exactly one person, actually, that was going there. And Josh had a whole bunch of friends, since he's from Iowa, that went from the Dubuque area to Iowa State. So I kind of got absorbed sort of into that group that included Josh and a bunch of others.
Very cool.
And all of them had played a lot of disc golf in high school. So it quickly became a thing that, like, I don't remember the order, actually, in which it happened, but we had this end of semester tradition where we would play, like we had like 12 people that would play in two groups of six end of the semester, like kind of like a party round to celebrate being done with finals.
That's so cool.
Kind of started with that. I remember we all had like one disc, a couple of people maybe had more than one. I was throwing a number one driver from Lightning.
Wow. I was going to ask if you knew if you remembered what it was. That's amazing.
Yep. I still have it somewhere.
And somewhere in that college range, before UDisc really maybe was a thought or before it came around, you kind of played with a fob locator or some kind of disc locator in a class. Is that correct?
Yeah. Good research. So as an engineer, one of the like components to your degree is that you have to do a senior design project, which is generally like a year long project in a group with other engineers to develop a prototype a lot of the time of some kind of physical product or software product or something like that. And since I was in the department I was in was like the electrical and computer engineering department. So I took a lot of electrical engineering classes as well, a little bit of like circuit design and processor design and things like that. And nice. My group was a couple of electrical engineers, a couple of computer engineers, and the way it worked was the community and other professors and things would pitch like senior design project ideas, and then you would get to sort of vote on like which ones you were interested in working on, and then they would assign people to groups based on your interests. And I was reading it, you know, beginning of my senior year of college, and there was one that was like disc golf disc locator, and I was like, I play disc golf every day. Like, so do all my friends. Like, this is great. And so what we ended up building, it was like a little thing you stick on the bottom of a disc. And then we had a key fob, kind of like a car, you know, like a car key. And you could pair, I think it was five discs to it. So there were five buttons on it. And then if you pushed a button, like whichever beeper that was paired to that button would beep. So we had to do a whole bunch of, you know, integrated circuit design, a little bit of firmware and make it waterproof and make it as light as we could. And our budget was like a few $100s because you're not allowed to spend very much. So it's next to impossible to really do something, you know, commercially viable.
You used a key fob, if I remember correctly, and didn't use like Bluetooth on a phone or an app, because that really wasn't an option at the time, right?
Nope.
Like, what year is this, and what were the options like at that point?
Yeah, this was 2007 and 2008. So I graduated in 2008, and the iPhone came out in 2007. So that was really the first like modern smartphone. I'm not even sure if the first iPhone, I guess it must have had Bluetooth, but I imagine that it was very limited and it was probably like Bluetooth 1.5 or something like that. That was, you probably weren't allowed to integrate with it in any way, I'm sure. Apps weren't even a thing.
Yeah, apps weren't a thing.
They had, when the iPhone first came out, there were apps that were built by Apple, but there was no app store. There was no concept of like a third party building something and selling it. It was a fun project. And the biggest challenge with that was just, you know, the budget. I think you're only allowed to spend like $200 or something. And building an integrated circuit that's custom for $200. Like, we had to do all the work, all the soldering and everything. One of our, actually Alex, the roommate who got me really hooked, he was the one that built the entire circuit, you know, was soldering it all by hand, and it was very large. It never would have been something people would have wanted to stick on a disc, but we at least proved that it was possible.
Yeah, absolutely. We're talking early adoption. We're early days of even that technology being possible in a way that a disc would still maintain a normal flight. At what point working on the FOB, like, did that lead into then this idea for UDisc, or how did UDisc come about after that?
Not directly. I would say that what the senior design project sort of led me to was that disc golf was a much bigger sport than I had realized. And that there were definitely opportunities in it if it were something that you wanted to pursue. But it wasn't really like some epiphany of like, hey, I should try to make some business in disc golf. It was more just, you know, we had to do a lot of market research. That was part of the senior design project. It was basically, senior design project is kind of like, in a way, it's kind of like how to start a business, but not the business side of it. It's like the engineering side of it.
Yeah, for sure.
Which part of that is market research. You always need to make sure that you're not going to build something somebody's already built. I wish I could find the senior design report. I've looked a few times and I can't find like the final, like the finished version of it, because it would be really cool to look at. But
absolutely,
I know that we did market research and we're like trying to see how big the sport was, engaged, how many people played. And like, you had to guess, you know, like, what is the market for this product? How many people you think would buy it and that kind of thing. And I just remember thinking like, yeah, you know, disc golf is way larger than I thought. And you know, maybe someday I could work in it and that would be really cool because I like disc golf. But that was basically the extent of it.
That was almost the first UDisc growth report, like 0.0 right there.
Sort of. Yeah, it was. So that was 2008 and it was 2012 when the first version of UDisc came out. So there was a 4-year span in there where I went to work for a big company, pacemaker company, and was writing software for them. In a nutshell, there were two things that kind of came together. One was apps were becoming a little bit easier to build. At the very beginning, they were very, very challenging and there wasn't a lot of help out there, especially on the Apple side of things. It was just kind of a black box and there weren't a lot of good training resources. It became a little bit easier. And I remember I'd always wanted to learn how to build apps. It was something that smartphones were still really new and it was just like this exciting, cool thing. And it was different than what I learned in school, but I really wanted to learn it. And so that coupled with being really in love with disc golf and playing, like, I was the guy playing 3 rounds a day back then. Like every single day I was playing 3 9-hole rounds at least after work. Wow. Every single day.
Still number one flyer, or are we, have we moved on?
At that point, I definitely had a backpack and was, you know, one of the first people with, like, in fact, I was early enough where they didn't have the backpacks yet. You had to buy the backpack straps for like the end of a starter bag that you'd, so you have to spend the extra $40 to put the straps onto the the shoulder bag. The genesis of UDisc was really just that I wanted to learn how to build mobile apps. I really, really wanted to learn how to do it. And I was talking with some coworkers at my day job who were a lot smarter than me and older and more experienced. And I was saying to them like, hey, I want to learn how to do this. How could I possibly learn something so complex, you know, without like schooling or something like that? And they were just like, you need a problem to solve. So I let that kind of percolate in the back of my mind for a while. And the really like the point at which it became a reality was my friends and I went to play this course, Bryant Lake Park, which if you're from Minnesota or the Midwest, you probably heard of that. We showed up and there was a cop sitting in the lot turning everybody away because the course was closed for the season, which I had no idea that was even a thing. Because it's like, it's, you know, on a park property where they actually pull the baskets in the winter to not damage the grass since it snows a lot here. And we were turned away and we were really mad because we drove like 40 minutes to get there.
Yeah.
And we didn't know that part of town. But I just remember like, I'm sitting in the driver's seat, like the cop is telling us, you guys need to get out of here. And we're like, we don't know where to go. And so we pulled over on a side road. We figured out a course and we went and played. And I was just like, this shouldn't be so hard. Like there should be a way to just use this nice GPS that's in my phone to say, tell me where all the courses are near here.
And thus you had a problem to solve.
There you go. Exactly. Yep. That was just really the genesis. As with many businesses, it's like solving problems for yourself and for your friends. And it's, you know, a very unoriginal story, but that is how it happened. It was just, I got frustrated and I was like, this should exist. Most people have smartphones these days. I love the sport. Like, I think it's time to dedicate a lot of time towards solving this. And that's how UDisc came to be. It was initially, it was only a course finder. That was it. There was no scorecard. There was nothing else. It was just, you'd open it up and it would go right to the map that would show the courses on it. And all you could do is click on a course, see the name of it, and hit a button to get directions. And that was it.
So 2012, the first version comes out and you decide to put time and energy into this. But
for the next 5 years, you still have a full-time job, correct? Like you're putting time and energy into this, but like double time.
It was a very rough, but very rewarding period, I think, of my life, just working at least 80 to 100 hours a week between, you know, a 40-hour day job and a 40-plus hour side gig. So there was not much sleep, a lot of personal sacrifice. Like I lost touch with a lot of my friends because I was so into this. And it seemed like it, you know, it definitely was worth it. I don't necessarily regret like anything like that, but it was a concerted large amount of effort. Things like this don't just happen. Like it doesn't, you don't just will like a complicated piece of software into existence. So there was a lot of late nights and a lot of early mornings.
Yeah. In that 5 years, was there never an option of not doing it? I know that's a double negative. Or were there moments where you thought about kind of hanging it up?
No, there was never a moment where I wanted to stop. It was, that's the thing when you're working on something that means so much to you personally and so much to your friends personally, it doesn't often feel like work, especially kind of the juxtaposition of working for a big corporation at the same time and going like, you know, this is cool. They pay you a lot. You're working on stuff that helps people, but it's not necessarily like personally meaningful to you and your friends. You couldn't even explain to them what you're doing at that job. It's not even within the realm of understanding for them because it's so abstract. And then you're working on this disc golf app and you can take this phone and hand it to your friend or even like hand it to my mom and be like, hey, mom, look what I built. And she can play with it and be like, oh, cool. I understand that. It was always just kind of like the good feelings you get from working on something fun that kept you going and made it worth, you know, sacrificing a lot of sleep and a lot of time and energy and money and relationships and just a lot of things that had to go by the wayside to make it kind of the bigger picture, just to make sure that like the community as a whole would benefit from this. It was always about like my friends and other people that play, just like giving them something that can make disc golf more fun.
Yeah, that's so cool. As with most, you know, computer engineering, just engineering principles in general, you're going to have V1, V2, multiple prototypes, etc. Do you remember any point in particular when it was just like, we did it?
Yeah. So we haven't really touched on when Josh joined yet. I think that's probably the next kind of chapter in this. So 2012 is when I put it out. It was still just me. Like we said before, Josh and I met at school. We worked. I didn't really talk about that as much, but like Josh and I basically took every single class together for the last 2.5 years of college. Like we planned it so our schedules were the same. Him and I and a couple other guys, just it's a lot easier to get good grades and like get your assignments done if you have some friends to help out. So we...
Yeah, it's easier to play disc golf together if you're on the same schedule too. So I see you.
You said it. Yep, that was definitely a thought. So we took all these classes together. We graduated. He went off and got a job as a consultant for a big, big company. I went back to Minneapolis to work at a corporation. And then he was sort of talking to me at some point in like 2014 and just saying like, hey, he wasn't really happy with his job and he was thinking about quitting. He actually took a trip to New Zealand, I believe it was, and went hiking for like 3 weeks because he was really unhappy like at his job. And like while he was there, he met this entrepreneur who like basically convinced him that he should just quit his job and go do something fun. And he came back and was like, hey, I'd really like to work on this with you. And I was like, okay, I could certainly use some help. And so he started, you know, he built like this little prototype of something to kind of like, he had never done any mobile before, but I knew he was, you know, a brilliant programmer and would have no trouble at all learning. But he sort of built something as his resume, like, hey, I built something for an iPhone. And it was like, cool. Okay, that works. Let's do this. And so basically he came on full time before I did. I was still working. I mean, I was probably working 40 hours a week for Udisc, but I was also, you know, still had my day job.
Earlier you called it a side gig, but I think if you're doing 40 hours for both, at that point you just have two gigs.
Yeah. I mean, that's the really more what it was, especially on the weekends. I would work, you know, like 20 hours each weekend on Udisc probably.
Dang.
So Josh, you know, he was just like, I want to come do this. And so he started working with me more and more. And that's when we built the first version of what is now today called Udisc Pro, then was called Udisc Cloud.
Nice.
Because cloud, you know, everything was cloud in 2015.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he built the first version of Udisc Cloud, which is Udisc Pro now, which is basically just the ability to save your scorecards and all of your data to an account. Doesn't necessarily get locked in your phone. Like in the old days, if you got a new phone, if you wanted your scorecards to go to that phone, you'd have to like sync it with iTunes or sync it with the Google Play Store somehow and then download all your stuff again. But that was kind of the point at which I would say that things became a lot more serious. That was sort of the initial point, because that was 2015. And then at the end of 2015 is when we started talking with Steve Dodge, when the Pro Tour was getting going.
Yeah.
And that was, I think, kind of the other moment when things kind of really went to another level.
So I guess we can say, all thanks to an entrepreneur from New Zealand and Steve Dodge, UDisc started to truly pick up steam and take our sport to the next level. After the break, Matt and I talk about the biggest problem in disc golf, how UDisc is on a mission to solve it, and why traditional golf might have caused more harm to our sport than good. This episode of Patent Pending is brought to you in part by Paragon Disc Golf. If you've watched Jomez's coverage, then you've definitely seen Paragon's work, whether you realize it or not. From feather flags and tee signs, to shirts, polos, and hats, to tags for your local club, Paragon prints disc golf. So if you're a local retailer or even a local club getting ready for the 2023 season, or if you just now remembered that you should probably get started getting ready for the 2023 season, then Paragon is ready and willing to partner with you to shape the future of disc golf. You can visit ParagonDiscGolf.com or simply click the link in the show notes. This episode is also brought to you in part by DiscDot, a brand that's ushering in a new level of competition for disc golf. DiscDot's namesake product is a simple yet effective tool made in the USA that provides instant feedback to help you dial in your putt. Just focus, putt, repeat. But I know that might sound too easy, so don't just take my word for it. DiscDots are now used in disc golf training programs worldwide and by some of your favorite pros like Gannon Burr and Kristen Tatar. This past year alone, DiscDot helped three of their players become world champions. So if you want to take your game to the next level, you can visit discdotusa.com and use code PATENTPENDING to save 10% at checkout, or simply click the link in the show notes. Welcome back to the show. I know I'm not saying anything really new, but in 2020, our sport exploded, and a unique opportunity presented itself to Matt and Josh. Armed with the mountains of data about the sport and its growth, paired with partnerships with the likes of anyone from the PDGA to the Disc Golf Pro Tour, UDisc began to realize its role in furthering the sport's growth, something they crystallized with their mission statement. And as you listen to this next part, I want you to notice something that stuck out like crazy to me. Matt is so stoked about disc golf. Whether he was talking about building out a team of 20 plus employees or problems with translation and disc golf terminology in general, he didn't stop smiling. And I can't say for sure why he continues to be so excited after working 80 plus hour weeks for years on end, but I have a feeling that it all stems from the fact that UDisc's mission is crystal clear.
Until recently, there were only a few companies really in disc golf, and they were almost entirely disc manufacturers. We're not a disc manufacturer. And so when we came in, we recognized very quickly, we want to work with everybody because our true mission is to grow disc golf with technology. That is our mission statement, grow disc golf with technology. And we want to make sure that we're enabling ourselves and the sport to do that. And so, you know, we recognized early on that we want to work with everybody who that mission resonates with, who wants to grow the sport. And I know that grow the sport is something that's thrown around a lot and kind of cliche and all that, but there are, you know, concerted efforts and strategic things that need to happen for that to actually become a reality.
Absolutely.
And so anytime that, you know, we've had an opportunity to partner with somebody who does good things for the sport, we definitely take it. We want to work with everybody that wants to, you know, see disc golf get bigger and better and more accessible. I think that's something that's especially important to us of late, is just making disc golf more accessible, because disc golf's biggest problem is still awareness.
On that note, if we're going to throw the phrase grow the sport around, I feel like I can't help but bring up the UDisc growth report. Can you talk a little bit about, like, what was the idea for that early on? Because obviously the app itself delivers one product to customers and to users, but it also has a massive data collection. You're able to generate some reports that are incredible. So what was that report like early on, and what was the idea and vision behind it? And then did it evolve in a direction that you almost like didn't anticipate? Has it taken on a new life of its own? I'm kind of curious on all of that.
Yeah, it's definitely been something that we had talked about doing a long time ago. We just didn't really have the resources or the bandwidth to put something like that together, but So we've done it 2 years now. We did it in 2020 and 2021. Everything just kind of exploded in 2020, as I'm sure many people listening know. And I'm sure a lot of people listening didn't even play before 2020, because there's just, Absolutely. You know, there's a huge influx of players. But generally what happened was we realized that, you know, we have lots of scorecards and lots of just information about the sport that other people don't. And we wanted to share it because we really do love the sport. We're not, you know, we're not out here like trying to make money or like be some big company or something. Like, we want disc golf to be played by more people, like, bottom line. And we were like, yeah. How could we, like, what is the best thing we could do to help with that? And we looked at some other industries and like what they do to try to build awareness about the sport. And there just wasn't anything out there that was like, here's how the sport is growing. There are some things put out by other entities that represent a very small fraction of like highly competitive players or something like that. But there was nothing out there that was just about the sport as a whole. So that was really the motivation for it. We're like, what could we do that would get the attention of the Wall Street Journal? What could we do that could get the attention of an outdoor sporting magazine or something like that? This was the answer. And it certainly has taken on a life of its own. Each year now we have, you know, like 8 or 10 people dedicated for like almost a month building it.
Wow.
You know, researching, finding these stories, these success stories to tell, you know, getting all the nice looking graphics together and everything. Since this is not a visual podcast, if you're listening and you haven't seen it, it's udis.com/growth. That'll bring you right to it. And you can check out the 2022 report. Yeah, it's very interesting data just to like look through and like kind of visually see how fast the sport's growing. Like, the number that we always are just blown away by is the number of courses added each day.
Yeah.
So in last year, there were 5.28 courses per day added around the world.
Mind blown.
And that's not just added to UDisc. That's like physically, you know, like opened for play at some park or in some property or something like that.
I mean, to keep going on those numbers, we're talking last year, it's 79 countries, 17 million rounds scored on UDisc. I mean, let's go back to like playing rounds with the buddies after finals and, you know, building a fob locator and then just like grinding away on those early coding, just late nights. I'm sure, you know, I don't know if you were fueled by coffee or Monster or what, but you were fueled by something. When you think about that, like 17 million rounds scored, 1.1 million individual players. Can you believe that you create an app that's being utilized by so many people?
It still blows my mind. More than anything, I'm just happy that that much disc golf is being played. Like, it's not about me and it's not about like us as a company. It's just like really, truly the sport getting bigger makes me so happy.
Yeah.
You know, seeing this many rounds get played, and, you know, we're only recording, I think we've estimated that about 20%, we think around the world, about 20% of rounds are being scored on UDisc. So that number, multiply it by 5, and you know, that's how many rounds were probably played last year. You know, this rivals other sports of much higher stature in terms of you know, hours of recreation and things like that. And it's mind-blowing to me that we've gotten this far, and just that the sport, like, I feel like I've been very lucky. Like, I was kind of in that generation that I existed before the internet, during it, and like now in the age that we're in. It's kind of the same for disc golf. Like, I saw it a little bit, you know, in the early days. I played before, I'm pretty sure I was playing before the Destroyer came out. And now we're at this point where it's like disc golf gets on ESPN sometimes. And, you know, we have DGN, which is, you know, a pay-per-view, like, you know, subscription service to stream every big tournament. And we've got Jomez and all these other post-production companies and other people like finding ways to help the sport grow. It's not just us. I like to think that we've helped a little bit, but it's, in the end, it's just, it's super exciting to see the sport getting bigger, but I still think that there's a ton of work to do.
Yeah.
Like I said before, disc golf's biggest problem is awareness. And so the best thing you can possibly do as an individual to help is bring somebody new out to play, buy a disc and give it to a kid at the park who looks interested, like find your old, the disc you don't throw anymore, keep them in your trunk. And if you see a kid that's, you know, watching you play or something, like, give it to them. You never know, like, they might be the next Paul Macbeth.
Yeah.
And like, that's the kind of thing that gets me really excited. Just the pool is growing and we're starting to see that really come to fruition on a lot of aspects of the sport. Like the FPO field to me is one of the big ones. Like, more people are playing now on the FPO side. And so we're getting better players, and it's just, it's so wonderful to watch.
Yeah.
I haven't really mentioned it yet, but one of the cool things that has happened to UDisc as a company, up until the beginning of 2020, it was still just me and Josh. And now there are 21 of us full time.
Wow.
we've gone from a very small, you know, two-person show to a 21-person show that are all focused, all of our efforts on disc golf. And we've got people from all sorts of backgrounds with all sorts of cool degrees in all sorts of various things, like who have left the industries that they worked in to come put their knowledge and time towards the sport, which that's, you know, beyond just more people playing, like that's something that really excites me, just that we have all these professionals that are willing to devote sort of their, you know, their livelihood to disc golf.
Yeah. I think I heard somewhere that you enjoyed kind of looking to other apps and other places for inspiration. I think All Trails was thrown out there at one point, or and some others. And then you just mentioned, you know, the team coming in who's coming from different areas of focus and discipline and just in general. What do you think about like the value of looking outside of our sport?
It's an interesting question. I would say that there are certain things that are easy to borrow, and software is one of those things where you don't always want to reinvent the wheel. People at much bigger companies than us spend lots of money doing studies on like what is the best way to get somebody to do XYZ or answer a question or go through some kind of experience in software. And like, I think it's really easy to look at bigger apps or bigger companies and sort of like borrow some design inspiration from them, or just how, you know, how something works in particular, and be like, I really like that experience. Like often when you're building something, you'll try to look at as many other things that are similar as you can and put together the pieces that feel good to you. You still have to write all the code yourself. Like you can't just like take their code and put it into your app. Like you're just getting inspiration for how it looks. I think that's really useful. One thing that I think is sort of limitedly useful is like our sport up until, you know, even currently, like we often look to traditional golf for lots of things to be like, how do they do this? How does this stat work? Mm-hmm. How does, you know, how do you present scores in a way that's digestible to the public? I think that that has been somewhat useful. And the concept of a scorecard, like that came straight from traditional golf, and the concept of how you present some stats and even some of the names of some stats, like what is a fairway hit in disc golf? Like that's something we struggled with a lot. Like, what does that really mean? What is a fairway in disc golf? Or even more importantly, like what is a putt?
Yeah.
In traditional golf, it's like, oh, a putt is from that short, you know, light green grass.
Totally.
And in disc golf, it's like, what is a putt? And so I do think that we've sort of gotten ourselves into some interesting situations in the sport where we've tried to borrow some things from, you know, like golf. Like a really good example, I know one that bothers some people is calling it a hole, like hole one, hole two, hole three. We don't play holes in disc golf. Like, and even back in the early days before baskets, they called like the poles, they called them pole holes. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that's part of where it came from. But like, they're just simple things like that that we borrowed from golf. Maybe people don't think about very much, but since we just sit here and, you know, work on disc golf all day, like we're always arguing over these things.
Yeah.
Like, what should we call it? Should it be a hole? No, I guess we have to call it that because that's what everybody calls it. But
So that's so interesting because I think a lot of us find ourselves in some of those conversations or debates with our friends and whatnot, or just some people find themselves in those debates online. But for you, that language translates specifically to your app.
Well, and I've got a good story for you on that one too, actually.
Please.
So UDisc at this point, I believe, I might be wrong, I think it's available in 12 languages, mostly Western European languages. And then we've got like Spanish and actually Japanese.
Very
and
cool.
Eastern European, like Estonian and Finnish and Slovenian and some of those countries. One thing that's been very interesting with that is that sometimes there have been like big arguments or big debates over like what a certain term should be, like a disc golf term in a different language.
Yeah.
A good example was like circle one and circle two.
Huh.
So we had a couple of Finnish people that were helping us translate. And there was this, I don't know how many comments it ended up being on Facebook, but it was like hundreds of them arguing over, should it be, I can't remember what the word is in Finnish, but I think the word for circle in Finnish starts with a K.
Okay.
And so they were like, should it be K1 and K2 or C1 and C2? And in the end, they decided that it should be C1 and C2.
Hmm.
My point here is only that some of the things that we do kind of unintentionally, I think, have influenced like what people call certain things in other languages that play disc golf. Like, do they just borrow the English term for everything, or do they make their own? And we definitely take that very seriously. Like it's, we don't want to be like, we're not the ones actually translating it. We have people that help us do that, but we need to be very aware of that, that some of the decisions we make can have sort of big impacts on things that we never had thought about until we got in the situation.
That's absolutely wild. So I'm thinking about the individual listening to this who might have a tech idea or an idea in general, but specifically something that's going to, you know, tech and what you all do, it takes time and energy. Like you mentioned at the top, it takes money. To that person who has an idea for something that they've been kind of mulling over, like if you had the platform to just say something to them, what would you say?
I would say nothing comes easy and you have to put in a lot of real work to make anything happen. Having an idea is easy. Executing on the idea is not. And especially executing on it in a way that will be useful to people is not easy. And it's going to require a lot of sacrifice. I think that's kind of the biggest thing I've learned is there is a lot of personal sacrifice involved with building any kind of business that becomes, you know, somewhat successful. Is just, you know, your time is your most valuable asset and you need to figure out how you want to spend that. Some people want to spend it, you know, having fun and enjoying time with their friends and doing whatever that is. Some people want to build things. And I'm that person. Like, I want to build things. I'm not, you know, I used to just, you know, download music and listen to music all day and do all that kind of stuff and consume content. That's how I always looked at it. I used to be somebody who just consumed content. And then at some point I wanted to start making it. If you want to build a business or something, like, you need to go all the way in and don't be afraid to take a risk. Don't be afraid to quit your job and go for it. Like, it's scary, but it might pay off.
Yeah. Worth the risk. So looking outside apps like AllTrails and stuff like that, what comes to mind with tech that's missing in disc golf? I know your mission is to, you know, grow the sport and specifically technology focused. So obviously I'm not looking for any trade secrets or anything like that, but as far as tech that's missing, that seems relatively obvious or even stuff that you've launched recently, is there anything that you were like, this is missing and we need this?
I wouldn't say it's necessarily, you know, a tech focused thing that is missing, but I still think that we need a lot more outreach to beginners. I think that beginners in disc golf are sort of a sect that, like, once you get really into the sport, I think a lot of people fall into the category of, like, seriously casual or casual serious players. And people in that bucket, like, they want harder courses and they want better courses and they want faster discs. But what truly is going to make the sport bigger and more mainstream, whether that's what you want or not, is getting more people into the sport. And the best possible way to do that is 9-hole courses near big populations. In terms of sort of like to bring it to the tech side of things, like, we've really been focused on using the data that we have in our data science team to focus on that and to try to identify places where there should be courses that there aren't right now, and working directly with cities and stakeholders at cities and stakeholders in municipalities, just people that can get things done. We really want to see, like, we're working with some people that are trying to get some courses in some very large metropolitan areas, in some parks that are, you know, millions of people visit each year. That's the kind of thing that I think we can really leverage sort of our skills and our, you know, usage of the app to be like, hey, 20 million rounds are played this year, whatever the number ends up being. And a lot of them were in this area, but, like, look at this huge metropolitan area where, you know, 10 million people live and there's no courses. Like, you can spend, like, disc golf courses are dirt cheap to install compared to, like, anything else. Like, a tennis court. I don't know what a tennis court costs. I'm going to guess it's on the range of at least $50,000 to $100,000 to put in a tennis court. You can put in multiple disc golf courses for that amount of money. You just need the space.
Yeah.
And so it's the kind of thing where, you know, if you can afford $8,000 or $10,000 for baskets, some time to pour some tees and some space, like, you can put in this really high value recreation target for your communities. And it's something that we've really taken to heart. Really, the growth report is what made us start thinking more about that and realizing that the key to the sport getting bigger is more courses. And I think pandemic in 2020 really highlighted that too, because we went from disc golf being pretty popular to suddenly, like, almost too popular, to the point where courses are packed and, like, people are having a bad experience because they show up and it's, you know, they can't even start for half an hour because they got to wait for five other groups to tee off. And, you know, that's really where our heads are at right now, is like, what can we do to get more courses and how can we build more awareness about the sport? How can we get, you know, numbers in front of the right people, the decision makers, like the people deciding how, you know, tax money gets spent, like, they want to see data. They don't want to just have somebody come in who's really passionate about disc golf and be like, you should do this because I like it. It's like, you should do this because, you know, here's the numbers that back up how much good it's going to do for your community. There's been some success stories. If you read the growth report, like one last year was Calgary, they had a couple of courses that were closing because of environmental concerns. And we were able to work with them and get them some information. And the city gave them funding to build 6 new courses last year.
Wow.
They lost 2 and they gained 6. And that's not an isolated thing. That's happened, you know, a bunch of other places. Something that we're definitely really proud of is trying to back that effort as much as we can and just making sure that, you know, the data goes to good use. You know, the more people that score on UDisc and the more that you log your rounds, like that helps everybody. Like we're using this to try to, you know, get these numbers to the decision makers and the people that actually have the power to, you know, authorize funding for new courses and things like that.
That's Matt Kruger, one of the founders of UDisc. As of this recording, over 1.1 million disc golfers use UDisc, and one of them scored 1,335 individual rounds in 1 year. I'm not kidding, that's 3.6 rounds every day. And if you're wondering if that's a challenge to you, yes. Yes, it is. All jokes aside, whether you play one round or over 1,000, simply just scoring it on UDisc is something you can do to shape the future of disc golf. So in a 2017 interview on Smashbox TV, you said if you were to print out all of the code for UDisc, it would be 2 800-page novels. I'm sure, I mean, maybe you're so into data that you've done it, but if you had to guess, how long is that book now?
I really have no idea. All I can say is it's probably at least, like, I would guess 3 to 5 times what I said.
Wow.
In 2018, just because we didn't really have a website then. Our website was just a landing page that was like one page that was just go download the app and here's a button to go do that. And now we have a whole full featured website with a course directory and all the leagues and the stores and UDisc Live and like all these other things. So I have not done it recently, but man, it's a lot.
Suffice it to say, it's a long book. It's a long novel. It's a series.
Mm-hmm. But now that you've asked me that, I'm going to have to go try to figure out an answer. So there goes my Friday night.
Thanks so much for listening to the show this week. After recording, Matt reached back out to let me know that UDisc codebase would now take up well over 10,000 printed pages. But he also wanted me to let you know that even though he was combing through code, he still enjoyed his Friday night. Patent Pending is presented by Jomez Pro, and you can subscribe anywhere you listen to podcasts. If you want to follow us on Instagram, we are at Patent Pending Show. And if you want to contact the team, our address is patentpendingshow@jomezpro.com. This episode was produced by Andy Padula with music composed by Starframe. I'm Jesse from Trash Panda, and you've been listening to Patent Pending.